Hi, I'm Mel Pickup, Chief Executive of Bradford Teaching Hospitals, and welcome to this month's episode of our podcast series, where I'm sitting down with colleagues and partners from across the Trust and the wider community to find out more about them and their contributions to the health and the well-being of the people here in Bradford. This month, as we celebrate the 75th birthday of the NHS, I'm joined by two colleagues who have had a long and distinguished career supporting patients at the start and at the end of life. Gillian Simpson is a midwife who started her career at St Luke's back in 1973, and Professor Alex Brown is a consultant in elderly medicine and formerly our undergraduate medical education director at the Trust. Morning, both.
Good morning.
Let me start by asking Alex you a question. Despite always wanting to be a medic, you actually started your career in the military. Can you tell me about how you ended up in the army when you wanted to be a doctor?
I used to watch a programme called MASH, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. I think it's still actually on the TV if you
flick through the various channels. Yeah.
Which was based around a sort of the Korean War, and there was an American army unit of medics, and I just thought, I fancy that. Mix of the army and being a doctor. But I got careers advice from my careers master at school, who said I wasn't posh enough to be an army officer and I wasn't bright enough to be a doctor. Now, despite him, I managed to do both, but not at the same time.
It's strange, isn't it? I can tell you similar stories about, I think, it probably wasn't MASH for me. I think it was sent elsewhere. And that's how I ended up becoming a nurse originally, yeah. What made you make the decision then to leave the army behind and pursue your sort of second career?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed my time as an infantry officer. I managed to travel all right around the world, do lots of operational tours. But when you get to sort of late 20s, you get to a point where you've got to start growing up, I think. And if you're going to have a family life, then the military's great as a bachelor. But with sort of family commitments and things, lots of travel abroad and things, I had to have a rethink. And the idea of doing medicine was still there. Mm. And with the help of my commanding officer and his support, I actually managed to get a place at Leeds University as a mature entrant.
So it's fair to say then that coming out of the military and becoming a medical student as a mature student must have been a huge culture shock.
Well, it was a hell of a culture shock. I went from army officer, getting married, and then going to medical school all within a 2-week period.
Wow.
And the first day at medical school, and they did it for the right reasons. They actually gave me they called it a big brother mentor, who was somebody who was 19. I don't think he'd even started shaving yet. So that was a bit of a shock to the system. And it was just, I think it has changed now, but at the time, I don't think the university was set up for mature students who had other experiences and other commitments. Mm. I remember distinctly, my wife was a general practitioner and we had two small children. And it was the stage where GPs did their own on-call from home. And I used to answer the phone when she was out. But part of your medical training is you're supposed to go and live with a GP family. When I tried to explain to the medical school, I was a GP family. I already did it. If my wife was on call, I couldn't be away from home because we had two small children. This still insisted that I went and stayed with a GP. Luckily, it ended up with a GP in Wakefield, and we lived in Pontefract at the time. So he just told me to go home, which was a sensible thing to do. But it was frustrating at times.
Yeah. And were you able to sort of take any of those skills that you'd honed in the army? I mean, you know, the sort of leadership bit into university life. Did you become the captain of things and the leader of things?
Well, I was joined the Territorial Army, actually, strangely, when I was at university. So I had this sort of schizophrenic life. I was a medical student during the week, and then at weekends I was actually a company commander in an infantry unit. So balancing the two off was actually sometimes a little bit difficult.
Mm. And how did your fellow students view you?
Initially, I think, was suspicion. But I'm pleased to say a number of my colleagues here are actually, they're younger than me, but were at medical school with me, and we're good mates at the moment, so it can't have been too bad.
Oh. Gillian, I believe one of your early memories as a student involved holding umbrellas over the heads of patients as they were moved about in all weathers between buildings, I guess, at that time.
Yes, it was, yes.
Yeah.
You can't believe that was allowed to happen, but that was the norm. And you'd to push up quite a hill, and you'd be pushing the trolley up the hill, hoping that, for goodness sake, it didn't roll backwards and cause any accidents. We never did have any accidents, but when you speak to the older women from years and years ago, they come back with things like that and they can now laugh at it, at what happened.
Yeah. It's funny, I did a radio interview today, obviously to mark the 75th anniversary of the NHS. And I did make the point, because oftentimes I think people have referred to the NHS as very, very, very slow to change. You know, people have said, well, it's a bit like turning a super tanker, and it's very, very slow and very kind of hard to get that change. It takes a very long time. But actually, I think increasingly it changes quite quickly. It's becoming much more agile. And actually, if you look back, like that anecdote you've just shared with us, and I could share similar ones, you would never imagine that what happened then would ever have happened when you compare it to how things are today. So clearly things have changed, but we perhaps forget about them because they just change over a period of time.
Certainly. I mean, we used to be able to smoke on the wards as staff, and patients smoked. And you look back with horror and think,
you do,
how does that happen? But again, that was the norm and you never thought anything wrong about it.
Well, one of the, I mean, you know, when I was training as a nurse, it's only, you know, 35 years ago, which is a fair way, but it's not 1973 when you began your career. It felt like, in retrospect, you know, much of the stuff that we did was only ever designed to keep people in bed for very long periods, you know, recovery. And now we know that the evidence suggests that that's the worst possible thing you can do. And I'm sure Alex has a view about that from caring for older people and the impact that bed rest and being in hospital has. And we'll probably touch on that later. Gillian, I'm interested, though, what drove you to be a midwife in the first place?
I've always loved children from a very young age. When I was, I can't remember what age, maybe sort of 8 or 9, if people that lived near where I lived had babies, I would always go and visit them and hold them. And that's all I ever wanted to do. So I decided that I would do my nursery nursing, and I went to Lancaster and trained as a nursery nurse. And then got a job at St Luke's on the special care baby unit, where I loved working with the poorly babies, the babies that were small, and just watching the midwives and in awe of the midwives that were there. And I thought, oh, I'd love to be a midwife. Mm. So I decided to do the direct entry training, and fortunately got in, and then started my midwifery training on the 1st of April 1975.
Wow.
And the rest's history,
One of the things we often talk about today, you know, going back to that, how the NHS has changed, is that patients, and in your case, the women that you care for, are seen much more as partners in their own care than sort of recipients of it. And I can imagine that's been very much the case in maternity services, even more so, perhaps. How have you observed that change since going back to the 70s?
A huge change. Back then, women were all in it. We were in a 7-bedded ward and we looked after the women. There was no one-to-one care like there is nowadays. You didn't see many relatives around, when I come to think of it. I didn't see many husbands around. And we would just go around the women, listening into the baby's heartbeats as pupils. And then if you found them that you thought, oh, they were ready to deliver, you'd then go and knock on the sister's door with trepidation, hoping that you were right, saying that I think this woman's about to deliver. And then they'd come out, and then we'd move them down to the labour ward and do the delivery. And all that's changed nowadays. It's, you know, we do try and achieve one-to-one care. Women were in for a lot longer then as well. 10 days was seen as the normal. And nowadays, they're wanting to be home quicker, and they are home quicker. Also, when we were looking after the women, we really didn't ask them their opinion. It was, we told them, this is what we're going to do, but they never questioned. We just said, we're going to do this, and that was fine. Mm. All women were ARM. They had the waters ruptured when they were 4 centimetres dilated, full stop. And that's you know, doesn't happen nowadays, thank goodness. But it was a fun time. It, you know, I enjoyed it back then. I still love it now. But it didn't put me off anything. I just enjoyed it.
Mm. What are your strongest memories then across your career, do you think?
I mean, strongest memories of my own delivery with my own three children. Mm. That was good. Delivering staff whose children are now 21, 22 that I've delivered years ago. Women that have unfortunately had a stillbirth in the past and you see them sad and then you come back and you're fortunate to be at their next delivery and to see them then happy is such a wonderful, it's an upsetting sight as well to see because of what they've been through. But they've come through that and they've then got a live baby to take home. And that is wonderful.
Mm. One of your career highlights, though, probably came, and you've not mentioned it, in 2014 when you were nominated to attend a garden party at Buckingham Palace. That must have been fantastic.
Oh, yes, couldn't get over that. Knew nothing about it until I'd got the letter saying that some colleagues had written to Buckingham Palace. Brilliant time down there. The weather was great. Loads and loads of people. I was quite, you know, such a lot of people that were there and got to see the Queen and her husband, Prince Philip, and all the other royal families that were there as well. It was really exciting. To get there, it was really a nightmare because there we were dressed head to foot in brilliant clothes, but you couldn't get a taxi anywhere because it was so busy. So there we are, sat like I don't know what on a tram.
With your hat on.
Hat on and shoes on and everything. But we got there and a thoroughly great day.
Fantastic. So you obviously have a wealth of experience, something that's such a valuable commodity when we're talking about the next generation of midwives and how you can share your knowledge and your experiences with them. What advice do you give to younger midwives and other colleagues that you must be very active in supporting their learning and helping them to be the midwives of the future?
Yes. I would never say never, ever be afraid to speak out. If you think anything's not quite right, don't keep your mouth shut. Always speak. There's no such thing as a silly question. And don't be afraid to ask. Don't try and run before you can walk. And learn the basics. That's the start of your career. And always be truthful.
Alex, you chose to work and specialise in medicine for elderly. Tell me a little bit about how you made that decision.
Well, I'm being perfectly honest. I think it was a pragmatic decision in the first place because when I came through training, there wasn't any set training programmes for 4 or 5 years that there are now. And you had to move around a bit and spend 6 months here and a year there in different regions, different hospitals. And obviously with the family and things, that wasn't practical. So elderly care came up. I did an elderly care job. I actually liked it. I like the variety of what we see. I like the fact that these people have, you know, great life experiences that they can share with you. And I also like the fact that it's what we would describe as sort of holistic medicine, where you're trying to tailor what you're doing for somebody for the needs of that individual. So you're not just following a sort of recipe sheet that somebody's come in with chest pain, this is what we've got to do. You've got to tailor it considering their frailty, what their expected length of life is, what their expectations are, and what their social support is. So I like that variety of it.
And you're such an advocate for the whole of our services that are framed around what we do for elderly patients here at the Trust. But there's another dimension to that particular service, which is trying to get people home, isn't it? And to preserve their independence and the mobility and everything that makes them able to go home, and then getting them home and supporting them, initially at least, whilst they are at home through a virtual hospital. That has to be something that we have to grow, I imagine, over time as our population ages.
Yeah. I mean, we've all got a vested interest. We all want to get old. So we've got a vested interest to try and get it right. I mean, we were one of the first elderly care virtual wards where we go out to people at home, try and support them in their own environment. I mean, hospitals aren't the right place to be if you're a little bit confused, a little bit frail. You know, the toilet's 10 yards away. When you're at home, it's 2 or 3 yards away. Mm. You've got your own surroundings, your own things. And trying to get people home supported to give them some quality to their life, I think, is the ultimate goal for elderly care medicine.
Yeah, yeah. And as well as being a clinician with that passion for those elderly patients, you're also really passionate about the next generation of medics, aren't you? And a big part of your career, Alex, has been widening participation in medicine. What did you see as a medical student that you felt needed to be addressed?
Well, I had a very roundabout way to get into medicine, and I did it late. I'm pleased that I was able to do it late, but not everybody has that opportunity. So about 15 years ago, we set up various courses in the Trust to try and help local kids from local schools get in. In a strange way, it was actually easier probably to get into medicine 20 or 30 years ago because it was purely based on academic qualifications. A lot more children get A's at A level now, so universities actually have a bit of a headache. How do we actually par down the numbers who are applying? So there's other things they've got to do. So they've brought in clinical aptitude tests. You've got to show leadership skills. You've got to show professionalism. You've got to show that you've been caring, maybe worked in a care home. You've got to try and get work experience. Some kids, particularly in the private sector, are tutored in what to do so they can tick all those boxes. But children who are bright may not get that opportunity in some local schools. So we developed a one-day course, which we call Introduction to Medicine. It's been going for about 15 years now, and it's been taken over by one of my colleagues recently to try and give people those skills. And we also do an interview course for those who've applied to actually give them the confidence and the ability to actually do well at interviewing and improve their chances.
Excellent. And I've been lucky enough to be involved in some of that, and you see the breadth of the representation in those audiences and how appreciative they are actually of the support they get. It's really important, and never more so than actually this week. You know, only a matter of days ago, we had the publication of the NHS workforce plan that's talking about huge increases in the number of doctors that we're going to train. But controversially, in some respects, the idea that we can do that quicker. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think if people have life experience, particularly if it's a sort of associated medical experience, I think that goes a long way. Because when you start university traditionally at the age of 18, there's a bit of growing up to do. Mm. Where if you've already done that growing up, you could probably actually shorten what the actual length of time is. But providing it has the same depth and breadth of education, I see no reason why they can't shorten the courses for the right people. I mean, I think I always say this to colleagues, that to be a good clinician is not necessarily what you do every day, it's what you've forgotten. Because every now and again you see something and the light bulb moment comes on and you just think, that reminds me of something. I don't know what it is, but I know somebody who might be able to help me. Mm. And that's why I think the breadth and the depth of what they do is vitally important.
So a question for both of you then. So much has changed in the world and, of course, the NHS during your careers. Have there been times when you've thought, you know what, this isn't for me, I'm going to do something else?
Never. Never.
Most mornings at 6 o'clock in the morning when the alarm goes off, but usually by the time I get to work at 7:30, that's dissipated.
Yeah.
The world clock's had a chance to take the mick out of me, and I know I'm back at work and status quo.
Yeah. Ditto. But for all that, though, that doesn't detract from the fact that sometimes it's really, really hard. You know, we've just gone through the COVID pandemic, which tested us beyond anything that we've been tested before, I think. Mm-hmm. And there will have been, throughout your careers, moments when that's happened. What is it, then, that's stopped you walking away?
Great colleagues. Great family support. We're just a good team at on the maternity unit, and we all look out for one another, and we've all got one another's backs. Wouldn't work anywhere else, wouldn't want to be anywhere else, and I think we've got a great bunch of staff.
Mm. Alex?
I mean, I ditto, really. I totally agree with that. I mean, I think if you look at COVID, I think that was probably one of the best times in the NHS. It showed it at its best. People just rolled their sleeves up and were very brave in a lot of cases and just got on with it. Mm. And it showed the best in people.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was chatting with someone recently and I said it was the worst of times that brought out the best of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alex and Gillian, thank you both for joining me today and for your long and distinguished service in our hospitals. I've got one more question for you. I've been in Bradford, it's going on 4 years now, and I didn't know very much about Bradford before I came. I'm from Yorkshire, so I knew about the Alhambra. That's where I used to go and watch the pantomimes and things like that.
Still do,
yeah. But didn't really know an awful lot about Bradford. But what I've come to learn about Bradford is, I think it's really quite a special place, and I think it's quite a unique place, and it has a wealth of challenges, but a wealth of rewards. What does Bradford and working in Bradford hospitals mean to you?
Well, I'll tell you that. I mean, obviously working here is a major part of your life. And as you say, there are a lot of challenges. It's not a particularly rich city, but it has a lot of potential there, and it's trying to drive that potential forward. And as Gillian said, I think what makes work isn't the four walls or the geography of the place, it's the people that you work with. And I think it's just a very friendly place. And, you know, you speak to porters in the morning and stuff like that. And as I say, people take the mick out of me constantly for all sorts of various bits and pieces. Some of it I deserve, some of it I don't. but it's a family atmosphere. Mm. And that's why you come back to it.
I agree with what he says as well. And I just think the people of Bradford, on the whole, are brilliant. And they're happy for the care, and they're just pleased with what you've done and what you've given with such a diverse community in Bradford. And that's part of the loveliness of it as well. You know, you've got all the different people and different things, that how they work and everything. But Bradford sometimes gets a bit of a bad press. Mm-hmm. But it's a brilliant place, and it'll continue to be brilliant.
I think one of the key things about Bradford is it's got to believe in itself. Mm. You know, it sometimes listens to that bad press and believes it. Mm. It's actually got to believe in itself. There's lots of innovation in the hospital, the research centre and all that kind of stuff. Mm. We've just got to believe that we're up there at the top, and I think we are.
Well, we just come off the back end of the Bradford Literature Festival. That's a seminal event. You know, so many visitors from within and out with the city and the district, even globally now. An amazing event. And, you know, in 12 months' time, City of Culture.
Yeah.
Huge opportunities. Fantastic. And all really kind of paving the way that as you said, we need to believe in ourselves and really go for it. Mm. Brilliant, Bradford. You're both fantastic examples of what has made the NHS so successful as we celebrate our 75th year. Thank you so much for all your contributions and for being a part of that before, now, and as we look to the future.